You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a show for you today. How to build an API. This is something we did, probably 3 or 4 years ago. So we are going to do an updated version of that. How do you build an API? What is it? What are the parts that go into it? Should you put all of the pieces together yourself, or should you reach for a off-the-shelf solution that sort of does a lot of that for you? We are sponsored by three awesome companies today. The first one is Payments Hub Dev Portal, your integrated payments partner to onboard and underwrite your merchants. LogRocket, they do JavaScript session replay, and FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. My name is Wes Boss. I'm a developer from Canada, and with me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I'm doing good. Yeah, just, you know me, doing my stuff, working on my Svelte refactor, my website. It feels like you're in that zone of a redesign where it feels like 80% there, but the reality is it's probably closer to 50%.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like it's 80% there. And so there's so many times I'm looking at it, I'm like, this thing's basically done. And then I just went through last night and I kind of did one of those, write down every single thing that needs to be done with it. And
yeah,
now I'm just staring at a massive color coordinated, all of those things, to-do list of like what I need to get done for what time and in what feature, what section of the website. And I'm just like, I got to get some work done.
Oh yeah. That's the most frustrating thing. And that's why people don't finish things, is that,
oh yeah,
like the last 10% really isn't 10%. It feels like you're almost there, but in reality, it takes almost just as long as you spent so far to get it polished into a point where it's totally finished up.
Oh, totally.
That's maybe a show that we should have at some point, is like estimating and understanding that the tiny little polish, the little click handler that has an edge case, takes 5 hours, whereas the initial implementation took you 1 hour to implement.
Pushing through that last bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's get on into it. An API. Let's talk about what is an API and why you might need an API. So the web is generally built on APIs. And what that means is that you have servers that will take in requests based on what you want to do. So literally every single thing that you do, you type into a box and you click on save. You click on an X to delete something. You edit something and update it and click the save button. Every single time that you perform an action, send a tweet, like a video, they take what you've done in the UI and send that information to a server. And that server generally has a bunch of API, what they're called endpoints, that can interpret those instructions and do what it is that you want. So post the comment on the video, like the item, start recording, send a notification to someone. There's all kinds of stuff that sort of needs to happen. And generally, if you're building a backend, a large portion of what you are building on the backend is the instructions of what needs to happen when somebody does a specific thing. And that is what an API is. Is that a good idea of what an API is, Scott?
Yeah, I would say so. I have some like thoughts going around in my head about an episode I wanted to do about like, do you need an API? Because I've kind of, as we're getting closer and closer to our PHP versions of our websites, I kind of get less into the territory of needing an API or feeling like most sites need an API. So if you're wondering and you're sitting there and like, do I really need this? Do I really need an API? It really depends on what you're building, right? It depends on who's consuming it, how many places are consuming it, and what exists there. But I think your explanation of what an API is was fantastic. Yes.
Yeah. And I guess there's probably different levels of API, because like if you have, let's say you have a PHP website and you make a file called add.php. And so when somebody hits that website with a post request, and it adds something to the database, that is an API, right? Like, you know, it doesn't have to be like a full blown standard API, yeah, with a documentation and types and everything. It simply just could be a URL that somebody visits or you fetch request to and hit it. There's certainly different levels of it. And I would recommend, if you have never built an API, definitely throw most of this out the window and just start with a simple route in your application that when posted to or hit with a fetch request will do something.
Yeah. I guess what I was getting at was more of like, you know, WordPress sites typically before, if you're not thinking about like WP JSON or whatever, you hit the server, it returns HTML, not data, right?
Yeah, you're right. Like a website or like server rendered application. I guess it's true. That's true. Like most websites, if it's not an application that does things, but it simply just serves up HTML, then yeah, it definitely doesn't need an API.
Yeah, totally. Okay, cool. Well, let's get into like different types of APIs that you might see around, or words, or I guess most of these are acronyms. Although I found out GraphQL is not really an acronym or anything. It's just its own word. So we have REST, we have GraphQL, we have gRPC, and we have tRPC. These aren't like the only options here, but these are the kind of the big boys. With REST, what you're doing is you're sending over a GET, POST, PUT, DELETE via HTTP requests. You're sending those messages to the server. The server accepts whatever type of message that is to the given location, and then it handles that information on the server side and will either return data correctly or return just a general response saying that data was received or the process that had been modification, whatever, had been received successfully.
Yeah, I would say it's really hard to say, but like most of the web is built upon REST, I would say, REST has been around for the longest. And REST is not, all of these things that we're talking about, REST, GraphQL, gRPC, and tRPC, these are not something that you install. These are just ideas in general that
tRPC you install.
Okay, TRPC, sorry. TRPC is one, but the rest of them are not things that you install. You certainly can install GraphQL, but the whole idea of GraphQL was initially just created in text form and then there are implementations of it in every single language. So at a very simple, in PHP, again, like you make add.php, and when somebody visits that URL, that's a GET request, or if somebody pings it with a fetch request, that's generally a POST or a PUT request. And I would say that those are the most popular out there because it's been around for the longest time. In the last, 4 or 5 years, GraphQL has become much more popular because the problems with REST APIs is that generally you want to fetch multiple things at once. Like, let's say we wanted to fetch a list of podcasts, but also a list of podcast hosts. Well, we could hit the API for podcasts, and there might be some parameters like limit. I want the 10. But then what if you don't want the show notes for every single one? Well, that's a lot of data coming across the wire if you don't necessarily need the show notes for each one. So then you create a second API endpoint, or you come up with, there's a lot of implementations around it. Elasticsearch has their own where you can say which fields you want. But that's essentially what GraphQL is that you can request multiple pieces of information and just the fields that you want in a single go. There's a bunch of more benefits to it. It has its own query interface. You can do mutations as well with it. And it is a bit nicer to work with. REST API is just super simple. You can return literally any data you want. GraphQL is a little bit more involved. You have to type most of your inputs and outputs, and you have to have a little bit more structure around how it works. But if you are building a larger API and something that needs to be a little bit more maintainable, at least right now, I say it's probably a little bit more preferable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had a little, it's so funny. I have so much conflict in my brain these days about APIs and I have some interesting feelings about GraphQL lately where I just wonder if there's for the majority of people using it, if they really need it in terms of like what it's doing for you, because there are a ton of benefits to it, right? The type safety is really great. Type safety up and down your API is really great. The structure, the organization of everything is really great. In fact, overall, I like working in GraphQL. You get caching on the client side with many of the clients, and you can kind of really standardize your APIs across whatever UI you're using. If it's a iOS or a web or whatever, you can utilize the same GraphQL API with really the same queries, same query language even, and know that exactly everything is going to be the same. And that's all wonderful. But at the same time, there's potential performance issues that you have to work around. You have to make sure you're knowledgeable about like performance and N+1 issues in GraphQL. You have to manage a whole infrastructure for your GraphQL. You end up typing the same schema several times in different ways. There's definitely like, I think, trade-offs to GraphQL where I really like working in it, but it does feel to me more and more like a GraphQL API is something that makes more sense at a larger, more complex scale than a smaller scale.
Yeah, I'll tell you, my main product, which is selling courses and distributing mm-hmm. them, let people watch them, tracking how far they have watched, all of that is done via REST APIs. Because
and mine's that's done by GraphQL.
so there you go. And I certainly have a couple of projects with GraphQL, but there definitely is something to be said for the simplicity of a REST API, especially when you look at things like React Query or a lot of these client-side libraries that make ingesting that REST API is very, very simple as well. I think that was part of the draw initially to GraphQL is that, the client side of this, the end thing in the browser is really, really nice as well. So I kind of want that.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts that I need to, I need to marinate on these thoughts a little bit more so I can properly articulate them. No,
just fire them off right now.
Yeah, I know. I was working on a little bit, not like a blog post, but like an outline even for myself to collect some of these thoughts about, do I really, like I kind of turn into my favorite scene in Bad Santa where Bad Santa is looking at the people stealing things and he's like, do you really need all this stuff? Like, do we really need all of it? And I'm looking at my API and like the one file that talks to the other file that talks to the other file to send the thing. And it almost feels like old school Redux to me where I'm like, do I really need this? Like, is this really?
Yeah, it's a little bit too much setup and overhead. And I'm glad that you say this because this tends to happen with literally everything. We get this new thing. Everybody says it's the best thing ever. And everyone says it uses to a point where people will ask me like REST is dead or they'll tell me REST is dead. And then we'll swing the other way. And like a couple of years later and people say, okay, now we're starting to hit some of the growing pains and maybe it wasn't the best approach.
I had joke, this is old school heads will get this, but I had jokily, this is entirely a joke, so don't screen cap this audio here, but I made the joke title for my like marination thoughts and blog post was GraphQL is considered harmful. But just because anytime back in the day, anytime that cycle would happen, someone would release an inevitable blog post that was, this thing is considered harmful. And it was always hyperbolic or whatever. Yeah. So that it was just an inside joke on my end here. What about gRPC? And I'll talk about tRPC in a second, but what about gRPC, Wes?
Yeah. I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know that it is
a thing.
It's a way to cross platform, send messages, and it is very lightweight. So we talk about, I guess the one thing we didn't mention is one of the benefits of building an API is that the web is not the only place where we interact with computers. As much as we like to think it, there are other things. There are iOS apps, there's Android apps, there are cars, there are terminals, there are beacons. There are lots of systems in the world that are not a web browser. And those systems need to talk to the servers as well to get information and save information and update information. And generally, those need to communicate via an API as well. So one of the benefits to having an API is that you can use the same server to talk from your drone as your actual website does as well, because they are all based on standards. So gRPC is a popular, it's what's it called? Something remote procedure call framework. It's created by Google. RPC was the initial one. Who did we talk to about gRPC?
I don't recall.
It's a lightweight way to communicate. If you use gRPC for something, tweet us at SyntaxFM, because it's definitely a bit of a blind spot for me, but it seems to be very popular in the outside of web development world.
Yeah, I would say it's a major blind spot for me as well. I mean, we all have many blind spots. Next one is tRPC, which is kind of a newer thing here. And tRPC is basically a way of, it's funny, it kind of feels a little bit like GraphQL meets REST in a way, but it's really, it's own thing. Basically, you get end-to-end type-saved APIs with less guff than TypeScript, or with less guff than GraphQL, because you're not necessarily relying on a schema, but you do accept queries kind of the same way, where you have a resolver, you accept the query by name, and then you can resolve that information. And then you also likewise have a tRPC client, like you do a GraphQL client, and you handle your client fetching by passing in a single URL like you do in GraphQL, and then do client.query, and then you ask for what you want, and it's fully type-saved. So what it feels like to me is it feels like many of the benefits of GraphQL without some of the pain of GraphQL, some of the setup stuff, some of the that sort of things. I haven't used it. I've only looked at the demos. So if I'm out here misinterpreting some of these demos in this code, please let's get us corrected here. We should have Alex on, who is the creator of tRPC. I know he's expressed interest in chatting, so we should have Alex on Syntax. We should send him a little message here.
It seems to me that the benefit of, I'm just looking at some example code right here, and it seems that the types are created at the resolver time. Like you could, like you're making a type for TypeScript anyway. Like why not use that for your API as well? Especially with a lot of the early like Apollo stuff was like you would have to create the server side types, and then you would have like another layer, which was the publicly facing types, because that might not be the same as your database types. And then you also had to create types for your client side if you wanted to have a lot of the fancy caching and whatnot. And it's just like, I think this is what you're referring to. It's just like, know, like this is a lot of writing where I just want to be,
scheming.
I just want to save the freaking thing if I want it. It's definitely got a lot better than that in the past, but certainly, I can see the benefit of this thing. They're using a library called Zod. What is Zod?
I don't know. Zod sounds like
TypeScript
a robot.
First schema validation.
TypeScript first schema validation.
Looks like they're using it to create the schemas in tRPC. Yeah.
Interesting.
There's a whole world here. I think we need to explore this a little bit further in coming episodes.
Yeah. I'm into that. I've been doing quite a bit of TypeScripting myself. So this is neat. Oh, TypeScript first schema validation with static type inference. Interesting. Cool.
What else is interesting?
Ooh, yeah. You know what? You know what I find particularly interesting is getting paid. And if you're the type of a developer who's building things where you need to collect payment, well, maybe you should be checking out Payments Hub.
Yes, Payments Hub, Dev Portal is our sponsor today. And it's really cool because they have easy to use APIs and SDKs that allow developers to create e-commerce websites, develop in-person point of sale application, and launch fully featured omni-channel payment solutions. What does that mean? Well, if you're making an app or a software as a service, and your users need to accept credit cards from somebody, then like you need like another step further, right? Like those merchants need to be onboarded and cleared by the credit card process. I don't know if you've ever tried to become a merchant on anywhere. There's a bit of a onboarding where they need to like see your business documents and all of that. And it's really tricky. And if you need to do that on behalf of your merchants, you need powerful APIs to be able to do that. And that's what Dev Portal by Payments Hub does. You're going to want to check it out at developer.paymentshub.com/syntax. You can get your merchants onboarded in as little as 90 minutes. Syntax listeners who become new partners get 6 months of free data through our business reporting API. Check it out. Thank you, Dev Portal Payments Hub, for sponsoring.
Sick. Cool. All right. Let's get into the next section here, which is we're going to be talking about cake. We're going to be talking about cake layers. Cake
PHP.
Cake.php. Yeah. So with any type of cake, you have good cakes, I'm going to say. Right, if it's a cake, it's a good cake, you got more than one layer. You got layers and layers and layers of cakes here. So we're going to be talking about essentially the API cake layers and what are types of layers that we have within our API. And usually the lowest layer, the layer at the bottom, is going to be the database layer where your database lives, and or your data lives, I should say. And a database can be any number of technologies. It's so funny. Databases, I think, are pretty divisive in the tech world, where if you say you use one type of database, people are always going to be arguing about it or telling you got to use Postgres. But there's a lot of different database choices.
It's always Postgres.
It's always Postgres, isn't it, right? Like, why are we doing this? Why aren't we using Postgres? All right, well, okay. Well, there's a lot of different choices. You can use any number of databases. There's just an endless amount of them, but the most popular options are typically MySQL, Postgres, MongoDB, in terms of like the actual backend database that you're writing. And this is, again, this is where your database lives. And typically, many people, when they host their database, are hosting a database that lives somewhere else, or is running on a server somewhere, or maybe it's running on a port of the server that you're running on. If you've ever installed a WordPress site, you'll know that you have to configure a MySQL database at some point in that WordPress install. Likewise, that is your database layer in your API or your website.
Yeah. So when you, after you've chosen your database that you want, you generally also choose a way to interact with that database. So you generally need a piece of software that will allow you to create models. And models are generally you have like an author model, and your author model, okay, that author has an email address, they have a name, maybe they have books that are related. So book could be another model. And most likely your software allow you to model those out or schema them out. And then they also are, you generally also have a JavaScript or PHP or whatever way to interact with it. So I use MongoDB, and I use a piece of software called Mongoose, which will allow you to query, create, update, all of that kind of stuff. Sometimes they are database specific, like Mongoose is just for MongoDB. Sometimes they are not database specific. So they're called ORMs, which allow you to use the same code, but then you can choose under the hood, they'll translate the things like create, find, delete, update. They'll change those methods to whatever the equivalent is in those databases. So what is the Node.js ORM that's really popular?
Prisma?
Yeah, Prisma is a popular one, but there is even a... There's another one that... SQLize, that's the one.
Oh, okay.
That's like a... We'll talk about Prisma in just a sec, but SQLize will allow you to write Node.js code, and you can interface with Postgres, MySQL, MariaDB, SQLite, and SQL Server. So you can choose whatever database you want, or most likely it's, all right, we already have a database that has data in it, and I need to be able to interact with it. I'm going to go ahead and use SQLize to work directly with that.
Yeah, and this can make make the ease of writing SQL queries way better, because you're not actually really writing SQL queries. You're writing SQLized code, you know, user.create rather than
exactly
the SQL query. And it looks, I mean, SQLized, given the name, should be kind of obvious. It does not support MongoDB style database schemas or database document style databases. Which is, you know, a whole topic that maybe we should get into. I know that's like a kind of a divisive one. People really hate MongoDB, even though it's very widely used. But yeah, these database layers and ORMs, I don't use an ORM myself anymore. I was using Mongoose, but we've since moved to native database validation from MongoDB. Would you describe the ORM layer as like a separate layer from just in general, the server layer that you have described here, or would you say it's part of the same thing?
I would say it's part of the same thing. Like, yeah, most people don't really care about the difference between the two. They just want to NPM install something and then be able to query the data, update the data as they need to. And sometimes mm-hmm. that's part of your framework, like Laravel. Sometimes that's an additional package that you install yourself, like SQLize or Mongoose and whatnot. Or sometimes the database will offer bindings themselves. And generally the bindings are, okay, here's a JavaScript function. You can run that JavaScript function and it will save an item for you. Generally, the ones that sit on top of the native bindings have a couple like nice features, and it's a little bit easier to use. And then that's always a trade-off, because you're not raw to the metal if that's necessarily what you need.
Yeah, totally. So at a big picture, we need some place for our data to live. And the next layer up is we need some place to be able to get or modify our data.
Let's go to the next section, which is the server layer. So this is where the logic for how your data is interacted with. And we should also say, like, you don't necessarily need a database for an API. You could make an API that literally capitalizes a word mm-hmm. for you. So maybe this is my
input transforms output.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're thinking, I've never built an API, literally go and make an API right now that has 5 endpoints, one that capitalizes, one that uppercases, one that reverses all the words, and then one that adds two numbers together. And those are silly use cases for an API, but we've seen sillier out there. And it basically say, okay, well now, anytime I need to add two numbers together, I have a server running somewhere at $5 a month where I can do that.
But what's cool about that example overall is not the usefulness of the API, right? As you know,
yeah.
What's cool about that is it covers so many of the bases. You'll be able to accept a request, parse that request, modify that thing, and then return information from that request and access it. And that's really like what you need to know, because once you know how to do that, all you know, connecting to a database and modifying or whatever the data from the database, pulling information from those are all different, you know, smaller details here, but the big picture is being able to accept that request and do something with it.
Exactly. And that's what the server does. The server handles the logic. So you have your request, somebody hits your API, and generally that request will have information about what happened. First, the method that happened, get, post, put, delete. Those are the big ones. There's a couple other ones. Then you have on a REST API, you have a route, meaning that somebody hit the route of /API/ customer. And if it was a post request, the customer API is generally you're creating a customer. Is it a get request? Or you're generally querying a customer. If it's a put request, you're generally updating a customer, and delete, you're generally, that's the whole idea. CRUD.
Totally.
Create, read, update, delete. That covers 98% of your use cases in all APIs. And
do you know what really confused me before you get on to the next bit? As a newer developer, one thing that always really confused me, I remember back in the day taking like code school classes, is the difference between CRUD and REST, because create,
that's true,
update, delete, whatever. What was the art? Remove, create, remove, update, delete, and then get, post, put, delete. It's like, how are these things related, and you know, what are the differences there? So just to be clear, that get, post, put, those are, you know, essentially HTTP to send those requests back and forth, where CRUD is more or less like a concept of like the stuff you typically need to do with your data.
Yeah, exactly. So in your server, when somebody hits either an endpoint or if it's GraphQL, the GraphQL only has one endpoint, but what comes along with the GraphQL endpoint is either a query or a mutation. A query is you're querying data. A mutation usually means you're updating or deleting or mutating data in some case. And the logic for what should happen when these things run are generally either called resolvers or controllers. Those are sort of the two big ones that happen. And what will happen is you write code inside of those. You say, okay, somebody has said, give me a user where the ID is 123. So what you'll have to do is you'll write the code, const user equals my database dot find by ID. The ID is 123. And then you query the database. It comes back. You say, if the user is there, then you return the user. And then if there is no user return, then you have to return an error message. And you generally also, you change the HTTP response code to something that like not found response code and whatnot. And all of the logic as to what goes on in there. You might want to do other things like create a customer. You might want to generate a temporary password. You might want to email them. You might want to flag their account as created but not approved. There's all kinds of stuff that needs to happen inside of there, other than just the simple CRUD out there.
And the important thing to know is that these things, at the end of the day, this is all JavaScript, where a message comes in to your route, and you can do anything. It can be a cascade of thing that does thing that does thing that does thing. And as long as, you know, you're making sure that the user is aware of the fact that the server is thinking or processing or doing all these different things, I mean, you can do a whole lot of stuff. It's not always having to be simple create, update, delete, whatever. It can be a whole cascade of exactly. Operations.
And we should also say, we'll talk about some of these boxed solutions. And often you will use a CMS or something that sort of comes with these things built in, because it also is kind of exhausting when you are, we talk about, well, not everything is just CRUD, but a lot of it is. A lot of it is simply, I just want an endpoint to query a user. I want to be able to update that user. I want to be able to delete that user. And writing four or five different endpoints for every single model that you have is sometimes unnecessary. So a lot of these frameworks will give you the very basics. And then you can step in and say, you know what, that was good, but I need to be able to add in a little bit more. And you can overwrite those. Keystone does this, where you're like, okay, I need to write custom logic for the create, because when we create the user, I need to be able to email them and create a slug for them as well. So that is a use case for the off-the-shelf ones as well.
Yeah, the off-the-shelf ones, what you lose in flexibility and pure whatever, you know, pure control, you gain in ease of use.
Yeah.
You gain in time spent. you gain in time with your children on the weekends. All sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And you also might gain a whole lot of, you know, nice rest-filled nights where you're not having to worry about if your LogRocket error program is firing off a ton of errors because you made a mistake on your API and your UI is having some issues. Well, this is actually a neat feature of LogRocket, which is one of our sponsors, is that when something goes wrong on your website, it gives you a session video replay that allows you to see what happened. But we're talking APIs today, and a relevant feature of LogRocket is simply the fact that LogRocket can give you the network requests in addition to that video. So let's say the user clicked on a thing, that thing hit your API, and there was an error somewhere in your API. It either returned the wrong information, or the request was denied, or it hit an endpoint that's returning a 500 error or something. You're going to be able to get access to that in LogRocket by seeing the actual network request that took place and see it as it happened when the user did the thing, so that you can solve this bug and debug your API because you chose to do something super fancy that, you know, you accidentally goofed up, because we all make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
So head on over to logrocket.com/syntax, sign up today, and you will get 14 days for free. You can check it out and really get a handle on how your users are using your stuff.
All right, let's move on to the next section of the cake, which is the authentication layer. Your API doesn't need authentication at all. You can simply just have it wide open to the world. And in a lot of cases, especially the read APIs or the query APIs, they are wide open to the world, meaning that you don't need any authentication to be able to do it. But generally, there are things like deleting users or querying specific parts of a user, like you wouldn't want someone to be able to query a list of all of your users and their email addresses, just from being wide open. So generally you need authentication layer. And I guess maybe we should roll this in permission layer as well, or should that be its own layer of the cake?
They feel very close to me.
Yeah.
I usually put them together in my mental picture, but and along with, you know, authentication is the permissions. So maybe this user does exist. They're logged in. They have they're authenticated as being they are who they say they are. But do they have access to do this thing? Are they have the proper role? Do they is their account verified or whatever the types of permissions you might have in place on your server? It's important because when we're working, especially with databases. Security by obscurity, in fact, of just having an API endpoint that exists that can do operations on your database, having it not locked down by some sort of permission system is not really an option. You need to have permissions on your database to do anything. So in this layer, it kind of determines who can do what access do you get? Does this user have the proper role level to be able to do the operation? And since this is being all taken place on the server side, right? Typically what happens here is a request comes in, you have what either is their cookie or their session or any of that stuff. You pull in the user information and all of this is taking place on the server. So it's not like it can be spoofed. The server is checking into the database. It's looking at the database, looking at that access role permission, and then acting as sort of like a bouncer saying, hey, you can come in, or hey, GTFO, get out of here.
Yeah, it generally, every single request that comes in, you will look up the currently logged in user. And that's, I guess that's part of the authentication layer, is that when people sign up or sign in to your application, you authenticate them. You see if their password is correct, or it can go a little bit deeper with things like third-party login and OAuth and whatnot. And there's generally two ways to do that. There's JWT, JSON Web Tokens. Once they are logged in, you give them a little token and you say, hey, anytime you want to query something or delete something, totally cool, but make sure you bring this token along. You know, you put it in their hand and whether you, generally that JWT can come in any number of ways. Some people put them in cookies, some people put them in local storage and then send them along. Some people will, it depends on the client as well. But generally it's just like a little like, here's my token. I'm good. I'm allowed to do these, the following things.
My mom said I could be here.
Exactly.
Mom said it was okay.
Mom said it was okay. I'm allowed to query these movies. And then there's also, go ahead.
Do your kids, are they at that age where they're like, mom said it was okay. And then like,
that's
Courtney, did you say this is okay? No. It's so classic.
We're at a point now where some of our kids will say, like, mom said to ask you. And then I'd be like, Caitlin, did you say to ask me? She said, I said no. And they just asked the other parent.
How do kids come, like, I remember a child and doing that exact same thing, but like, how do kids come up with that? That like, it's just like innate that like a kids just like decide that that's like what you do. If one of the parents says no, the thing you do is you just go ask the other parent.
Or sometimes I'm just too exhausted to even do it myself. Anyway, so that's JWT. there's also session-based stuff. Session-based stuff is generally browser only. So a lot of the newer APIs built in the last 5 or 6 years will use tokens instead because you have an iOS app or you have a security camera, you have other stuff that needs to log in, and there's no concept of sessions. As well as you talk about servers, the server implementation often with serverless and edge compute, those things generally are run on different servers. So sessions gets a little bit more tricky there. So though that's the authentication layer. We talked about permissions layer. And then like, what other layers do we have here? I have client layer, which is not really part of the API, but let's think, is there any other part of the API? Interesting use cases like a photo and file upload. That's not part of CRUD. Well, it kind of is, but not really, because generally when you're doing file upload, it's a little bit more involved. You have to have different special types of forms called multi-part, meaning that it sends the data in multiple parts, right? You have a large photo. You can't send that entire photo over the wire in one go. So the browser is smart enough to upload it in chunks. So you have to be able to accept those chunks on the server side and then do what you will with them, send them off to a bucket to store them or resize them and send them back. It's kind of up to you. So that generally takes some different stuff. Same with real time. If you want to have
streaming
yeah. or real time, WebSockets. Why am I forgetting words for everything today? If you want to be able to do real time stuff that is not generally covered by a REST API, because a REST API generally is you have a request, you send it, you get a response. That's it, right? Open and closed. And streaming is generally you open it and you're listening for messages that come and close. And that's a whole different world, but it can still be part of your API.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And man, some of this stuff's really wild. I remember making some mistakes when I was a younger developer. Like all I wanted to do was send an image to a service or something like that, where it's something I could have done client to that service, or even I could have done a serverless function or something, right? And I was sending all of that information to my server, which then sent it to that server. And then that's like, if you can unload things onto the client and not have to do them in your API on your server side, then that's just another one of those use cases where we're often talking about, like, what would you use a serverless function for, or what types of things can you avoid throwing into your API. You do have to be kind of considerate that when you're writing an API and you have a server here, that server is, you know, it's got to process these things, and it is just a computer somewhere running this stuff. So if you don't want to incur a bunch of performance, crushing stuff, you can always look at doing something like a serverless function, or whatever you can offload to the client is good for that too. Nowadays, we're getting all sorts of cool new things in the client side via WASM, and who knows what, where you can do all sorts of cool image manipulation stuff without sending it off to a server somewhere.
That's true. And also, they can, like, one neat thing about GraphQL is you can do this thing called schema stitching, which means that the actual work performed in the GraphQL API could live in 7 or 8 different servers, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't have to be on one single server, but it can be surfaced via one API. And then things like Cloudflare functions and Edge functions, those things can also give you a single API endpoint, but divert the work to wherever it needs to happen instead.
Totally.
Oh, we forgot the caching layer. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. We talked about caching before we recorded, and then neither of us put in the notes. It was probably my bad because I brought it up. There's also a caching layer on top of here too, which, like, a caching layer can come in handy because if your server is doing the same thing over and over again and it's always returning the same information, you can cache that information at the API layer to say, like, this API will always return the same information. We use a caching with our GraphQL API, and actually that's a positive of our GraphQL API, is that caching is really super easy for it. You can cache based on resolver, and each resolver can have its own caching mechanism for how often that gets saved. But you could store something like that into a service like Redis, which is like an in-memory kind of storage for information. And then instead of going to your whole rigmarole of having to query your database and take up that time, you can get really, really, really fast returns on information by caching things that are either accessed very frequently or things that are always returning the same information no matter what. Like, for instance, we cache our user information so that it doesn't, like, if you think about it, every single time a request comes in and you want to check that those users' authentication roles, sure, you're going to want to do that kind of stuff. But if the user object hasn't changed, then you should be able to pull it from the cache easily enough, yeah, reference that stuff rather than having to hit the database each time.
This is here. If you are building your first API, remember we talked about an API to add two numbers together?
Yes.
2 + 2, that's super, yes, resource intensive. You shouldn't have to...
My computer's on fire thinking about it.
You're going to... That thing is going to fall over. It's expensive. You're going to be broke. So what you could do is you could store 2 + 2. You could say, well, the inputs are 2 and 2 and the output is 4. So let me cache that result forever because math is not going to change. You will never have to use your CPU to add those two numbers together again because you could cache them. So that'd be actually really fun. At the very least, you could cache it in memory, or you could store it in a database or use something like Redis or... Literally anything.
Yeah, literally anything. Cool. You know what you could also use for literally anything? as long as you're accepting and doing invoices, you could use FreshBooks.
As long as you're doing online accounting.
As long as you're doing online accounting, it's basically anything. But anything that you're accepting money for, whatever, we all do money stuff. That's right. And
yes,
you'll want to do all your money stuff with FreshBooks. Wes, do you want to talk more about how you use FreshBooks?
Billing and payments all in one place with FreshBooks. You create invoices. You can get paid on FreshBooks. It gets deposited right into your bank account. You can do all of your invoices and expenses right inside of FreshBooks. You can do time tracking. If you are running a small business and you need to keep your books in order, you should check out FreshBooks at freshbooks.com/syntax. For a 30-day free trial, no credit card required. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick.
Let's go real quick, client layer. This is not really part of an API, but people are interested in it. In order to interact with your API, you generally need to do something in the browser or in your app. At the very basic, you can just use a fetch request and send it over. Even if it's a GraphQL API, you can still query GraphQL without having a fancy package because GraphQL just needs a string at the end of the day that is formatted in a certain way. But then once it gets a little bit more in depth, you can get things like React Query, Apollo client in the thing. They'll do caching on the client side for you, which is really nice. Generally, if you visit a website that is very snappy and whatnot, they will be caching that data in the browser.
Somewhere,
generally in the browser. Yeah. So that
local storage.
You got it.
What's the database that's in the browser?
IndexedDB.
IndexedDB, yeah.
So that's the client. There's tons of them out there. We're not going to go through all of them. That's probably its own show. But that's what you can do.
Totally. Cool. Well, that I think just about covers it. Oh, no, wait. We have also some...
Should we talk about this? This is we get questions about this in the Pollock all the time. I use X or X?
A service.
Should I use this or a package or something to install? So there are lots of companies and packages out there. Many of them sponsor this podcast where they will give you an API and generally also a CMS. So a CMS is nothing but an application that interacts with your API to CRUD, right? So we'll rattle through them really quickly and sort of tell you what they are. We're not going to tell you which one you should pick because my Instagram DMs are full of this. Which one should I use? Yeah. At the end of the day, they're probably all very, very good.
Which of your sponsors do you love the most?
So let's go through them real quick. Prisma is a popular one. Prisma sits on top of several different databases. And then it gives you a GraphQL API out the other end. It does authentication for you. It's pretty full service. It is open source package, but they also have a hosted version of it, I believe. Keystone is a CMS and a GraphQL API. They do authentication and they do pretty much everything for you.
Everything, yeah.
I have a course on it, advancedreact.com. Strappy, very similar. They are a open source package. Strappy does offer a premium plugin that you can add in because they are a company at the end of the day. Sanity is a hosted service. So Sanity is kind of interesting because you still write code to interact with Sanity. You define all your models and all of your logic can happen. But at the end of the day, Sanity is hosted for you and they provide 98% of the logic for you, which is pretty cool. Prismic, they're another sponsor of ours. They are a full API, but you do not need to write any code to create them. You simply just log in and create all the models and everything that's related to each other. And at the other end, you get either a REST or a GraphQL API. Hasura is open source and hosted, but you point it at database.
You point it at a database.
Postgres. That's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, you point it at a Postgres database, which is pretty cool because a lot of people already have a Postgres database. What are the other ones out there? There's so many.
Contentful. Graph CMS is now HiGraph. I don't know if you caught that. They changed their name.
No, I didn't. I like that. Graph CMS is... Why did they change it?
That's a great question. I could not tell you the answer. Maybe they're less of a CMS and they were always just kind of like they weren't necessarily a CMS in the classic sense, is that they didn't do UI stuff and maybe people were expecting it to do UI stuff, but no, it's just like create a GraphQL API layer for you.
Yeah. In the PHP world, Laravel is a very popular way to... get an API. They do other stuff alongside of that, but certainly they will give you an API.
WordPress.
WordPress is a good example of one as well. Drupal. Lots of stuff is an API.
A big portion of our industry is about building APIs and connecting data to databases and returning to the user. Yeah.
And then last, real quick, tools to interact with your API. GraphQL Playground, if you have a GraphQL API, they allow you to inspect your API for types as well as write queries and mutations. It's very helpful to take your debugging outside of the browser and simply make it about requests to make sure that everything works.
Did you see that Graphical got a glow up, I think?
No.
Yeah, there's a brand new theme for Graphical, and it's for a long time, Graphical was kind of like the ugly duckling.
That's why people use GraphQL Playground. It was just like a nice version of it.
And here, I'll post a link to the new Graphical here in the show notes. Graphical. And, that's an ugly link. Hold on, I pasted a link, and it had this like massive query string on it. All right, hold on.
Oh, they finally have tabs. Okay. So
basically got a nice coat of paint on it. It got tabs. It feels much more like GraphQL Playground.
You can add headers, which is important when you're doing authenticated requests. You're trying to debug. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice. I'm going to have to try this next time I'm debugging. I use one called Insomnia, which is really nice because you can Insomnia is it's a desktop app where you can create custom or commonly used API endpoints. And then you can save them as examples. So it's both documentation as well as a sort of a debugging tool. It's kind of like Postman, but a little bit nicer.
Really?
Yeah.
This thing looks cool.
Yeah.
What? Wait, you've been holding out on me, Wes.
I guarantee. We need to get the transcripts because I guarantee I've talked about Insomnia on this podcast before.
I see that it's created by Kong. I was wondering if it was the dog toy company, but it's not.
Postman is another popular one that's been around forever. And I think that's it. I was going to go into database tools, but we've done a whole show on that. So I'll leave it at that.
I use Studio 3T. That's what I use.
Okay, let's talk about database tools. Studio 3T is a good one. I use MongoDB, Compass, Table Plus. I've used if I need to interact with SQLite databases. I believe those are the big ones that I use.
Yeah. There's a whole host of these. Let us know I'm interested in knowing what kind of API tools and database tools you're using, because tools are one of those things you can never have enough options of really pawing through them, and I'm a tool head here, so
big tool.
Do you know Tool? Dude, do you listen to Tool, Wes?
No, I don't. They always intrigue me because people who listen to Tool love Tool.
Oh yeah, totally. My band played a Tool song in high school, and we won the Battle of Bands because of it. I got to the drum solo, and that was pretty sweet. One time, I saw Tool in concert at the Palace of Auburn Hills, where the Pistons play. And at the end of the concert, there's some guy stole the box of T-shirts from the merch table.
Oh,
and he's sprinting out of the concert with a box. I mean, he looks like a Tool fan. So just picture Tool fan in your head. And he's got a box of Tool T-shirts underneath his arm. He's running and he decides to hop a fence. But it was one of those like barricade fences that's like not secured. And so he does like a one-handed fence hop. As the police are chasing him, he does a one-handed fence hop and the fence just totally collapses.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
He bites it so hard. But I mean, this man has got a box of T-shirts. He's running from the police. He hops a fence. The fence collapses. And we're all watching this because I'm outside. And this man thinks at this very moment to not do anything but just yell, Tool! he yells Tool! like he's that dedicated. That will never leave my mind. Tool. This man yelling Tool as he's like about to be collected by the police.
That's wild. Oh, that's good. Yeah, it's certain bands. Same with like Fish Heads and yes. Grateful
I've also
Dead.
Seen Fish in concert.
Have you? Oh man.
I drove to Wisconsin to see Fish in concert. Yeah.
Unreal.
I accidentally, when I was leaving the venue, I got good stories for all this stuff. I was leaving the venue in my 1996 Acura Integra, and everybody was just kind of like cutting in line, so we cut in line, but you're driving off-roading, and I hit like a bump in the dirt and it ripped off my exhaust.
Oh.
So we had to drive all the way back to Michigan without exhaust.
Probably sounds sick.
It was great.
All right, let's get into sick picks now. I'm going to sick pick a laser level. This thing has been so dang handy for our new house, both for if you're doing anything from hanging a photo or if you are like I'm doing a little bit of work in my office and I need to make sure that things are level or I want to make sure that a line is straight right across the room or you're trying to hang shelves and like you have three or four shelves and you want to make sure they're all on the exact same level. A laser level that you can hang or mount on a tripod is so, so helpful with this type of stuff. So I got this one called the Huepar, H-U-E-P-A-R. It's not the best one that you can get out there. There's certainly like $600 ones that you can get, but this is like a $60-$70 one, and it does vertical and horizontal, and it is self-leveling, meaning that you can put it on a table that's like kind of slanted and it will self-level itself and cast it on. And it's been a game changer. Like we hung up our TV and we needed to make sure that it was totally straight, both putting the brackets as well as once it was hung up. And we just took this thing, slapped it on the tripod, or if there's something metal in the room, you can slap it on something metal. And I've used it like six or seven times. And I've just every time I'm like, oh, Caitlin, this thing is awesome. How did we live without this before?
I'm kind of currently feeling like that. My strategy, I wish I would have had this before we hung everything up in our house. Because my strategy of just taking a mechanical pencil and a giant level and just marking up the walls and then having to erase them and who knows what is did not necessarily be the best, best way to do that.
Oh man, honestly, hanging stuff up, I have such a good idea for an app that, you know, like with like CSS Grid, where like you can say space around or space between and you have, I have one item and I want to center it or I have two items and I want to.
You just like use your camera or what?
Yeah. Or just like, I just want an interface where I can input the number of things that I want to hang up and how wide the space is. And it will calculate it for me. So I know exactly where they are. Or if you have like two mirrors that you want to hang up spaced evenly, but those mirrors have two screws each, you know, like it gets like really complicated. So
it gets really complicated.
It's funny because I drilled a hole in my brand new desk and I did it wrong. And I was like, oh, it's because Flexbox and Grid has ruined my centering skills. It's okay.
Marginato's not doing it.
Yeah, for you. Exactly. Yeah. The real life is a little bit more real.
Yeah, a little bit more real. I'm going to. That's hilarious. I'm going to pick a. I got a whetstone for my knife sharpening, and I've been really happy with it. I don't know what you use, Wes, for your whetstone. I got this sharp pebble, and it was $40. So, you know, if you're like me, you probably haven't done a whole lot of knife sharpening. I know Wes has shamed people on this show about knife sharpening in the past, and I've always used this like weird drag the knife through sharpening one. And then I watched a YouTube video and this guy was like skewering that tactic of sharpening a knife. So then I felt really bad about myself.
Oh, knife
so
YouTube like, you know is a bit intense, but yeah.
It's intense. It is intense. And I got pretty deep into knife YouTube recently because our knives are old. They are, you know what, Courtney and I just had our 10-year anniversary. So our knives are 10 years old because we got them for our wedding.
Yeah.
And we did not take care of them for most of our time. So I'm going to get at least one good new chef's knife. I'm going Japanese with it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can sharpen a lot of research your crappy here. Knives. As long as there's metal left, you can make them sharp as hell.
I've been sharpening these crappy knives, but yeah. I've put them through the dishwasher like 10,000 times.
Oh, me too. I put all of my nice knives in the dishwasher. Honestly, like people put their nose up at it, but I ain't got time to hand wash a fancy knife. So I have a couple like nice knives. They're not like steel that will rust, but they're like pretty nice knives. And I just put them in there and I know how to sharpen them. And I've got very, very sharp knives. I have the, I have a whetstone that works really, really well. And then I also have, it takes forever, the whetstone. So if you've got 15 knives to sharpen, I got a couple of years ago, paper wheels for a, what's it called? A bench grinder. Yeah. So I got a bench grinder with paper wheels.
But you have
wheels.
To have a bench grinder.
Yeah. That. It's major buy-in, but man,
it's a major buy-in. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't set it up in the new house yet and I'm itching to do it because I have like a pocket knife that I always carry around and doing all these renos, I've just destroyed it by just cutting fiberglass with it and like cardboard boxes. It's really bad for your knives. So it's not very sharp anymore. So I'm just like, I need to get my bench grinder set up.
So either way, I got this Sharp Pebble premium whetstone. It's only $40 and I've used it a few times and our knives, like I said, we have not taken care of them and it has. It's made them tremendously sharper. And this one has two different grits. So you get a 2-for-1 here. And you get a 6,000 and a 1,000. And as somebody who has not sharpened their knives in a long time, I think this thing has made a major difference in my life. And it's definitely going to hold me over to like post next year where I can finally cash up or cough up some cash to get like a fancy Japanese knife. I'm going to get like one chef's knife, Wes.
Yeah.
Just to be like, I have a chef's knife that is going to be my baby. And then that's it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a slippery slope. I've been there before and I'm like six nice knives in and then you think, oh, like I have like a 9-inch one that is like amazing for cutting watermelon or like a pizza. Cause it's long enough to rock a pizza.
What style of knives do you go for? You go for like German or what? Like,
knife style. I'll tell you my favorite one is a sheep's foot.
Sheep's foot. Well,
no, that's not it. I will find out what one I have. Like a real, I took a knife class once, knife skills class once, and they gave me just like a commercial kitchen knife where like it's a plastic handle and like a good blade on it. And that thing has been awesome. And they're dirt cheap because they're meant for a commercial kitchen to have 20 of them. But then Caitlin got me like a really nice one from Crate and Barrel. Let me look it up. Let's look it up.
I want like a Hattori Hanzo style, like Japanese blade. Like, oh, I want something.
I don't have that anything that's that
has
intense.
Been blessed. Yeah. Something that looks like it's finally crafted.
Oh, I have a Wustoff. Wustoff. It's, yep. That's German.
Good brand.
I've got a couple Henkel.
Henkel, yeah. Yeah, we are Panzer Henkel. I like Henkel
the
pans.
Henkel has two, there's two kinds. There's like the two person and there's a one person. And one of them is like, you can buy them at Walmart. And one of them is like really, really nice. And and the part of the reason why I have so many knives is that I have an eye for them. And anytime I'm at a yard sale or a thrift store, is I'll rummage through the knives. And once every 30, 40 times, you'll see one. Like, oh my gosh, this is like, I have a 12 inch right-handed sushi knife that is just like massive, massive for cutting thin pieces of sushi. And I also use it for cutting prosciutto. And I got that for $4 hard to cut. At a garage. It's like $180 knife. I got it for $4 at a garage sale.
Yeah.
So you just like, sometimes people get them as gifts and they don't realize.
Yeah. This so thing, you're sitting on gold.
Yeah. I don't know. Then yeah. I'll, you know, we'll talk about knives. I'll stick pick my knife, my favorite knife next time, because I love this one. It's like, it's kind of like a square blade and it's my like go-to.
I've been watching so much Japanese knife YouTube that I am going to go to the Japanese knife store in Denver here, and I'm just gonna like talk to the guy for 20 minutes. So, and then I will leave with something, but we'll find out what it is later at a later date. I'm gonna shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. We have a new course on PNPM workspaces that I'm so excited about, because if you've ever wanted to use a monorepo and felt like the amount of tools inside of monorepos are just way too much and too intense, well, PNPM makes it so nice and easy. So I have a course that came out on September 1st, PNPM monorepos with workspaces, and it could not be any easier. So if you're interested and you want to learn about what PNPM is, how it could be better, how you can just drop it in instead of using NPM, and more importantly, how you can utilize this stuff to have monorepos, check it out, leveluptutorials.com.
Wusthof Nakiri knife is what I have. I found it.
Wusthof. Yeah.
And it's just funny because it's German and Nakiri sounds Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. So that's a hilarious combo. Anyways, shamelessly plug westboss.com/courses, a list of all my courses. You want to learn beginner JavaScript, go to beginnerjavascript.com. Use coupon code SYNTAX for $10 off.
Sick.
All right, that's it. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you on Friday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.